On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I go, oh my God, I've just read one of the great books of our time, you know, that really kind of sums up what's going on. She goes, well, you have to make it. I go, you know, I'm a comedy guy. No one's going to let me do this.
Adam McKay is the very successful writer-director of Will Ferrell hits, including Anchorman and Talladega Nights. But he needed a push from his wife before he let himself imagine he could do the movie version of The Big Short, Michael Lewis's book about the collapse of the housing market. Now, McKay and his film are nominated for Oscar. He talks about why he broke one of the basic rules of movie making with The Big Short. But first on the News Banter, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences makes dramatic and sure-to-be-controversial changes to address Oscars So White. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by a special guest partner in banter, Scott Feinberg. He is the awards analyst for The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Scott.
How you doing, Kim?
I'm good. Now, you are a special guest today because the Motion Picture Academy has, just as we are taping, dropped dramatic rule changes that they are going to make to address the diversity question. Of course, this is coming off of Oscar So White, the second year in a row with no people of color in the acting categories and movies that people thought maybe in contention, notably Straight Outta Compton, not nominated. And there have been a great deal of discussion about why this is. Obviously, Spike Lee said he would not attend, although he's an honoree this year. A lot of people under pressure, you know, to make a decision if they're going to come, if they're people of color, people calling for Chris Rock not to be the host. A lot of noise. The Academy said they would address it. Now they have made a major step. Scott, why don't you sort of walk us through the important points?
Sure. Basically, the news is that we learned on Friday that on Thursday night, the Board of Governors of the Academy met and approved a sweeping number of changes that are designed to make the Academy more diverse and thereby presumably produce more diverse nominees. They felt that they had to respond quickly to both correct the problems that they believe caused the nominations to be the way they are this year and last year, but also to stem the sort of tide of people fleeing the show and really going after the Academy. So the big news is that they are now going to transfer a lot of members to emeritus status, meaning that they will still remain members with all the privileges of membership except voting if they have been inactive for a period of 10 years after the time they become members, or if they have not at one time or another had three consecutive decades during which they were active. Now, what active means is still to be determined, and that's one of the questions we're going to ask the Academy. But also, another way around those rules is if you are a nominee or a winner, if you've ever been nominated or you've ever won, you automatically get to retain lifetime voting privileges, even if you immediately retire thereafter. So the idea is to address people who have not been a part of the business, not been a part of the industry for decades, but continue to vote because the assumption is that they are not reflecting the cinematic or social taste that the Academy is hoping to reflect.
So basically, if I made a movie and got invited and then was gone for how many years? I guess it's 10, but it's really more, it's not necessarily 10, right? It's, it could
well,
be
it's
more
a
than
complex,
10.
Yeah, complex formula because you've got here, what they're saying is that if a member has not been active in the last 10 years, they can still qualify by having at one time, and we're talking now looking back in the past for the current members, if they at one time had a stretch of three decades after they became members during which they were active, that gets you lifetime membership in the same way that having been a nominee or having been a winner does. So once you've worked for a stretch of three decades, it's not that they expect you to work, like if you're 90 years old and you didn't work in the last decade, you still get to vote if you had worked for a within three decades.
You had a career, in other words, a real career.
Right. Exactly.
So, I mean, one thing that, of course, just stepping back to the Academy's motivation here for a second, that TV show is their lifeblood, right? And it's already had its ratings issues. It's still a very big TV show, but not as big as they would like it to be. Getting softer, you know, especially with sometimes more obscure films have been, you know, seen as the winner before it even airs. It is really bad with pressure to, you know, possibly boycott even watching the show. It is a bad problem for them to have.
Yes, but at the same time, they also do have to keep their members happy, since these are the people who, you know, are their lifeblood, for better or worse. And
not the money kind.
Not the money kind. That's right. True. That's very true. But, you know, what you're having now, because the Academy is so heavily white, older, and male, the people who fit that demo, who are assumed to be the problem, are not happy at being labeled that, because many of them say, hey, you know what? Guess what? When I was young, I was a civil rights activist in the 60s or whatever. And to accuse me of racism is extremely offensive. And so what we're hearing is a lot of younger members who are very anxious to identify whatever they is at the root of what they see as a race-related problem, clashing in terms of opinions with these older members who say, race had nothing to do with my thought process, and we look purely on the merit, and what you're trying to implement is a form of affirmative action and also now age discrimination.
Right. I can see that that age discrimination thing would definitely become an issue because there has been so much recrimination about the older white Academy. Now, they've made efforts to increase the number of women and people of color in the Academy, but it's been pretty slow. They now say they're committed to doubling that membership of women and people of color. I don't mean if they mean each. I assume each by and doubling the number. I don't even know what doubling the number would represent. By 2020, they say they're going to do this.
Well, this gets to the core of the problem, which is that the Academy is supposed to represent the best of the film industry. However, if the film industry itself is not diverse and representative of those groups, then how can the Academy reflect an industry that doesn't exist? It's a chicken-egg situation. Now, on the one hand, you do want the Academy, I guess, promoting and encouraging diversity. On the other hand, you have people saying it is not acceptable to compromise the requirements and standards and things that we've had in the past so that you can meet your quotas. And so there is, again, a huge debate over this approach. And I personally, while I think it's a wonderful goal to get to that point one day, I don't know how they are going to find, to be honest, enough people with the experience that meet their existing standards, not because they can't possibly exist, but just because the industry itself hasn't created enough opportunities for them to exist yet.
So, I mean, we don't really even know what these numbers mean in a way, because the Academy doesn't release information about who's in it.
Exactly. They're a very secretive organization. They've never put out their list of their full membership. And, you know, there's questions about why that is. They claim that it's because they don't want their people to be lobbied. Well, guess what? You know, what people have done is they've scrapped together lists that are pretty close to it and sell those for thousands of dollars each year to different publicity firms, which then use those to determine, you know, screeners. In terms of screeners, they're not mailed to people because the Academy gave out their addresses. It's because these independent operators have put together these lists. And that's how they get invited to events and all kinds of things. So the idea that they're preserving some sort of sanctity of voting and keeping campaigning from affecting their members is a little bit crazy. And I think that what the root of that decision probably is that it would be very embarrassing for them to have it exposed just how white, older, and male they are.
Well, it sounds to me like we can't expect this to end the controversy anytime soon, but they're making an effort. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
That's Scott Feinberg. He's the awards analyst for The Hollywood Reporter.
The whole housing market is propped up on these bad loans. They will fail.
The housing market is rock solid.
It's a time bomb.
So Mike Burry, who gets his hair cut at Supercuts and doesn't wear shoes, knows more than Alan Greenspan.
Dr. Mike Burry, yes, he does.
In the film The Big Short, Christian Bale, now an Oscar nominee for Best Supporting Actor, plays Michael Burry, the eccentric real-life hedge fund manager who saw the 2008 financial crisis coming long before the rest of us. Bale is part of an all-star cast that also includes Ryan Gosling, Brad Pitt, and Steve Carell, who plays a hedge fund manager looking to make a pile of money even as he seethes at the obscene greed and lack of accountability on Wall Street.
Fine. You know what? I'm a mean guy, and I'm pissed off. You have no idea the kind of crap people are pulling, and everyone's walking around like they're in a damn Enya video.
Our guest today is Adam McKay, known for making Will Ferrell comedies before he took on the complicated story behind the 2008 financial meltdown. His decision to go in a pretty different direction has paid off in the form of 5 Oscar nominations. That's a huge win for him and for Paramount, the studio releasing the film.
We have a very good relationship with Paramount. We made a lot of movies
You've
over
made
there.
A lot of movies for them.
We have. We did, obviously, Anchorman 2. We did Daddy's Home. We did an action movie called Hansel and Gretel. We've done some indie movies.
Oh, yeah, Hansel and Gretel.
So we actually have a really good relationship with them, and we've been, you know, knock on lots of wood, very successful over there, too. But I think with this movie, it was, you know, it was a combination of Plan B. It was a combination of the source material. Michael Lewis has a good track record for his books being turned into movies. And then I think the big thing was that cast that we got, you know, it was pretty amazing. And then they genuinely liked the script. I mean, they really liked the kind of choice that I made with it. So, yeah, God bless them.
God bless them. I mean, I guess really what I'm trying to get at, it used to be in Hollywood, it used to be the thing, like if Mel Gibson made Lethal Weapons, then Warner Bros. Would say, go make The Man with Half a Face, Mel. You know, we know it's your passion project. And I don't know the genesis of this movie, but would you think that because of Will Ferrell's commercial value, that still exists in a tiny way, that's that thank you if we want you to continue to do the stuff with us, especially at Paramount where they're short of movies.
That's interesting. You know, it never overtly came into play. It happened so outside of the other movies that I found this book, got excited about it. So there was never any even implied sort of trade of Anchorman 3 for this. There was a rumor that there was, but there actually wasn't.
There was a rumor?
I thought I was
the only person who thought this.
They thought that it was like, oh, you'll do Anchorman 3 if we let you do that.
Right.
But that actually never
they
came
never
up.
They never said the words.
No, never did. You know, I've known Adam Goodman, who was the guy who was there when this
and
got greenlit.
Not now, yeah.
And Mark Evans. I've known those guys for a long time. We just have a good relationship. So they knew, at least if I wrote the script, that we were going to be in the ballpark. And then when that cast came on board, that was it. No, I think we actually earned this. I think this was not a...
Not just
what,
a thank
was it
you.
Called? Man with Two Faces, the Mel Gibson
I'm sure I just butchered the title of that movie. But.
Can we pause this and go watch that entire movie and come
and
back?
We'll come back.
All right, let's pause now. And we're back. That wasn't bad.
That was really a passionate thing.
Oh, beautiful film. Check it out.
Well, so let's walk through it a teeny bit. Where does Plan B come in? When does the talent come in? Just give me the it starts with you reading Michael Lewis's book.
Which is 2 years before anything happens. I read this book and I can't put it down. I pick it up one night at like 9 o'clock and I'm in bed early. My wife snacks me. I was like, oh, I'm going to take a look at this book. And I just, boom, I can't put it down. So next morning I go, oh my God, I've just read one of the great books of our time, you know, that really kind of sums up what's going on. She goes, well, you have to make it. I go, you know, I'm a comedy guy. No one's going to let me do this. I'm sure Scott Rudin has already bought the book. And
you would think, actually.
You would think. And so I completely let it go and went on. And we did Anchorman 2. I wrote Ant-Man. We had a lot of stuff going on. And I think around that time, I had started investigating The Big Short because my agent, Cliff Roberts from WME, had said to me, if you could do anything, what would you do? And I thought he meant like any comedy,
right?
Any action film. And he goes, no, anything. What would you do? And I just right away said The Big Short. So he made a call to Paramount, talked to Mark Evans, was like, you know, they had the script through Plan B and said,
so Plan B instead of Scott Rudin optioned the book.
Yes,
and
correct.
Plan B, obviously, it's Brad Pitt's company and they have been doing... They've been scoring pretty well
yes.
in terms of 12 Years a Slave and...
Selma and Tree of Life
yes.
and on.
They're doing pretty
yeah.
well. And so they optioned it. And again, they come to you. You go to them.
No, I go to them. Mm-hmm. Cliff calls them and says, you know, I represent Adam McKay. He is dying to do this as a project. And Dee Dee Gardner and Jeremy Kleiner are
so the partners of Brad Pitt in this company.
Exactly. Are like, oh, my God. That actually could work.
Really? They didn't go like, what?
Well, you know, there, Jeremy Kleiner really has been tracking what I've been doing for a long time. I had met with him before, and he was aware of the fact that even though, you know, I'd done these absurdist comedies with Will, that there was like a political point of view to him. He'd read my stuff on Huffington Post. He saw the Broadway show I did with Farrell, the George Bush or Welcome America. So he kind of knew I had this side to me. So he wasn't surprised by it. And Dee Dee was tracking it as well. And then we just had an incredible meeting. I told him sort of my big idea for the movie, which is to break the fourth wall, have a conversation with the audience. And it's the only way to do this movie. And then they gave me the script, the Charles Randolph script that he had written. I was like, wait a minute, this is a pretty good script. Like, there's some nice stuff in here. So I was even more encouraged.
So you take this script and you work on it.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go?
It was really fun. My wife kept laughing because I would like bound down the stairs every day to go work on this script. And I think because I had this idea of like you have to open the movie up, a lot of the tricky elements of it weren't so painful. You know, I did theater back in the 90s in Chicago, and we had played.
You were a founder of the Upright Citizens Brigade,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Very good.
Thank you.
And had done Second City and I.O. and done a bunch of different theater in Chicago. So I had played around with breaking the fourth wall before. And
which
then I loved
the movie. You're actually not supposed to do an improv, right? You're not never supposed to break the fourth wall.
You're not
wall.
Supposed to do it in anything. It's like right. The number one rule. In fact, the first day in film school, they tell you, show, don't tell. So. But I'd seen some movies do it really well, like 24-Hour Party People is one of my all-time favorite movies, the Winterbottom movie, and he did it masterfully in that. So I kept thinking, I think audiences are savvy enough that they can handle this now. So it was a very fun rewrite. I took some big swings and
– I'll just pause for a second and characterize, like, what is the most radical thing you did to that script?
Well, you know, for those who have seen the movie, I actually stopped the movie and go to different sort of pop icons who explain some
right.
of the financial esoterica
Selena
behind
Gomez or
Anthony Bourdain or yeah. So we have different people pop up. But then in addition to that, I have Ryan Gosling, who's a character in the movie, is also the narrator. So at any point, he can turn and look at the camera and say whatever he wants.
I haven't gotten to where you got the talent and who was in first. But
sure.
Did the budget get bigger or littler as you started adding these names?
Budget kind of fluctuated. It started around 35. We went and got all these names. I think Christian Bale was first in. Then Pitt said he wanted to do a role after he read it as a producer. So yeah, we got all these people in like a week and a half, and then we had to do the schedule game. We had to do the budget game. And I think by the time we went to shoot, our budget was around 30. And then we were quite crafty. We actually did really good work. We had our line producer was Louise Rosner, who really tightened the belt. And I think our final budget was 28 by the time we were done.
And did you feel that was like, I want this to be cheaper than what they're even giving me?
I did. I felt like I want this to be under the radar. I don't want people sweating it. I don't want financial sweat on the forehead with this. You know, there's a lot of things that go with making a movie where, you know, because I'm a writer and a director, I kind of can edit myself. So I was able to cut some fat out of the script that got the budget there and was really happy. I felt like, you know, I feel like every movie kind of has its natural number. And I felt like 28 was like perfect for this movie, right where it should live.
Now, you used an editor, Hank Corwin. He was known for the Terrence Malick films.
The name that kept coming up was Hank Corwin. Dee Dee Gardner from Plan B kept saying, Hank Corwin's your guy. Hank Corwin's your guy. And man,
were you going
she...
like, really? Tree of Life guy is my guy?
Well, I did love Tree of Life. And I, more importantly, he did Natural Born Killers, which I thought, that's a little bit what we're going for. We want to be mixing mediums and kind of playing around. And within 20 minutes of talking to him, I was like, this is our guy. And then he took the ideas I had and he went further with them. It was ended up being like one of the great collaborations I've had. And it was exciting when we started screening it and they were actually going for the style.
Coming up after a short break, Adam McKay tells us how he got The Big Short's release date moved into 2015, which put it in awards contention. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Yeah. Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Oscar-nominated writer and director Adam McKay about his new film, The Big Short. The movie follows the lead-up to the financial crisis of 2008 through the eyes of the few people who saw it coming. Ryan Gosling plays trader Jared Vennett, who puts the looming market implosion into comprehensible language. In a presentation to hedge fund manager Mark Baum, played by Steve Carell, he uses Jenga blocks.
Let me put it this way. I'm standing in front of a burning house, and I'm offering you fire insurance on it. A's, zero. B's, zero. Double B's, zero. Triple B's, zero. And then that happens.
What is that?
That's America's housing market.
You know, the clever, clever move in all of this, and I hope you will tell me about it. Paramount moved the release date up. This was supposed to open next year, this year now, 2016. Mm-hmm. And I'll say it so you don't have to. Paramount doesn't have a ton of movies at this time. And so maybe they were a little hungry to put something through their pipeline. But whose clever, clever idea was to move it up?
You know, it's so funny. A bunch of people have said that to me, like, oh, Paramount must have needed the movie. The truth is, I'm the one who told them.
All right.
A month in the cutting, said, I have never seen a movie come together this quickly. And I kept laughing, saying, I think we knew what we were doing on this one because I wasn't seeing any reshoots. The emotional thrust was working. And the movie was probably a half an hour longer than it ended up being, but it was still playing already. So I actually did a crazy thing. I invited Rob Moore, Brad Grey, Megan Colligan, Mark Evans.
The whole brass at Paramount. Yeah,
exactly. And invited them all to come to a screening before my director's cut was even due. And people were telling me, do not do this. This is crazy. The movie's not ready. And I go, I think it is.
People like who were working on the movie? They were scared.
They were scared. I mean, it's crazy to show a movie that early. But I was like, I think we got this. I can feel it. And
I like the confidence.
You can tell when a movie's in the ballpark. And in this case, they went for it. They walked out and Brad Grey shook my hand and was excited. and all of a sudden, everything sped up. And it was like, okay, you're going to have to hit these dates. You're going to have to get to work. So, you know.
And you were like, yeah, I'm going to do it.
I really felt like it was the right move. I felt like we were close. I felt like the markets, you know, the financial markets were kind of going up and down. Who knows with a movie like this where it could end up. But most of all, it was working. That's why I felt we could do it.
Was there part of that conversation, be honest, like we could win awards?
No, we did not say that. I would
did you
not,
think it?
Not until we got nominated for awards did I ever say that. It felt like a movie that should come out in awards season. And I don't really even call that awards season. It just feels like the grown-up movies come out in fall, right?
I feel winter. Like awards season is gradually taking over the entire year. But yes, the grown-up movies come out
true.
In fall.
It's kind of true. So we always felt like this was a good release time for the movie. But I'll tell you the really crazy story. So here's what really led to it happening. So I had this idea. I had the studio come. They agreed. And then I had a doubt about it. I said, God, you know, I don't want to rush this movie. But I felt really good about it. And I was going to call Dee Dee Gardner, who's like one of the great common sense, funny
obviously
people.
At Plan B. Yeah.
Yeah, that you'll ever meet. And in the middle of my phone call with her, where I'm saying, you know, we could hold this to March. We could go for, you know, another film festival. We get an email from one of the real people in the movie to our co-producer, Robin Woolley, saying, put this movie out right now. The markets are not looking good.
Wow.
Get this movie out.
And by the way, sell.
Exactly. And I just said to Dee Dee, I said, I think we have our answer. Let's go. And that was it. We hit the ground running. And it's crazy. Sure enough, the markets are down, 500 today?
Big fall today as we were talking.
2,000 in the last week and a half or
it's
something.
It's really not good. Yeah.
Hopefully it's, you know, it's not going in that direction, but scary.
I don't think I can do that again.
No, I don't think I can either.
I don't want to do that again. Somebody just said on our show, if you had told me that the guy behind Talladega Nights or pick one was doing this, I would never, a year ago, I would never believe it. Do you have a bug now? Because, you know, I sometimes wonder if you're doing movies like you do, do you sometimes feel like, yeah, this is really great. I'm successful. I love what I'm doing, but I want more I want to be about something really relevant. And not that that's been entirely absent from the
sure.
movies you've made, but this is about something very
well, this is very
center.
Overt. There's yeah. no question about it. What I loved about this was no genre. That's what I loved. Mm. I loved when I was writing it that I didn't have to end a scene with a laugh, that I didn't have to have a happy ending, which if you do a comedy, you kind of do. I mean, it's what the genre is. You know, we always try and mess with it and be clever with it, but I just felt no restriction in the sense that a scene could be sad, it could be visual, it could be funny. That was half of the most exciting thing about making this. The other half was the fact that we were making a movie while the story was happening. It was really cool. We'd show up every day and there'd be crew members with stories about, you know, financial laws being passed in Europe and trying to extradite bankers. And then you'd hear about a fine being paid from a bank here in the States and how the bank was doing a dance because they got away with it.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. I think the combination of those two things excited me about this and make me definitely want to do this again. It doesn't mean I won't do a comedy. I think just in the future, it'll be a little less restricted by kind of a traditional genre that we'll be free to kind of go where we want to go a little bit more. So
yeah, you can really, it's not a calling card, but it opens the door.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think when you go have that meeting, they go, okay.
You did this.
Yeah.
Impossible thing.
Yeah, and once again, doesn't mean we won't do a comedy, but yeah, this was exciting. There's no question about it.
So now you're on the circuit, you're working it. So Regency now has two movies, and yours and Revenant.
Yes.
Doing very well with both of them.
Yeah.
Do they show you, do you sort of say, do you love me as much as you love The Revenant?
You know, I just called Arnon and I said—
Arnon Milchan, the head of New Regency, the Israeli, we don't know what was going on there, arms merchant.
Mogul, we'll
mogul
call him.
Person.
I called him and I go, you know, you got to make a choice. You got to tank one of your movies.
Yeah.
And he immediately said that I'm tanking yours. And I was like, whoa, let me back off that.
He has a bit more money invested in The Revenant, a multiple of your budget.
It's true. It's been great. And Paramount's been really, you can always tell when a studio's behind a movie because it's their
Paramount,
job.
I mean, they've got nothing but upside here.
But you can tell when they really are into a movie. And
I
can feel the extra little heat on the fastball within the whole team I've been working with and seem to legitimately be into the movie. I mean, of course, you're right. Like, they're excited to have a movie. But and then at the same time, we had a movie we produced through Gary Sanchez, Daddy's Home, that came out.
Yeah, and then it, boom.
Yeah, so it was
life
like
is good.
One of the better Decembers I've ever had. I like it.
One more thing I wanted to ask about The Race. You know, people are saying the movie is a comedy, The Big Short. And,
yeah, I'm not sure I totally agree with that, but yeah.
Well, it's sort of very sad comedy.
We call it a traumedy.
For the abundance of trauma. And then people in the pundit world say, well, the Academy doesn't go for comedy. Is that a concern as you're in the middle of this? Do you have to go around saying it's not really a comedy?
No. I mean, you know how it goes. You make your movie, you stand by it, and whatever happens, happens. And we certainly love this movie. I mean, what's great is we're getting this response to the movie that is both. It's a tragedy and it's a comedy. So,
you know, the thing is everyone lived through it. It's not like people have to reach to relate for the most part, right?
Totally.
Everybody suffered.
Everyone knows how they have loved ones that were affected. They know how they were affected. So the response has been this great mixture of people kind of leaving with, you know, excited, angry, devastated. So to call it a comedy or a tragedy doesn't quite
work. A
little
simplistic, and, yeah.
Yeah, which is what I love about it. I think genres are starting to loosen up quite a bit, and this movie's pretty free of traditional genres.
Adam McKay is the director and co-writer of The Big Short. Thank you very much for coming in.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.